Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, February 7th. Today we showcase tales of survival for both vessels and individuals in the open ocean. We recall an incredible deep-sea rescue starting with a routine mission that went awry, how an unexpected collaboration saved a $2.5 million underwater robotics unit from a watery grave. We hear the harrowing story of a shipwreck survivor, how one Hawaii resident got more than he bargained for aboard an ill-fated vessel. Plus, what happens when ships aren't saved? We talk to an underwater archaeologist who chronicles our history on the ocean floor.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend HPR presents Ke Aho. This concert is a part of HPR's Mele Hawaii performance series. Ke Aho is performing this Saturday at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Mark Cafe, we're here about a dual-use conference called Partnerships in Dual-Use Climate Technology. We'll find out how startup companies can position themselves for Department of Defense opportunities. That's today at 6:30 on Bite Mark's Cafe.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 40 days and 40 nights. The biblical reference has dark overtones. It's what happened to a deep-sea ROV, a remotely operated vehicle tethered by a cable. It was cast adrift when that lifeline snapped in waters 15,000 feet deep, 60 miles north of Oahu. No one knew if the University of Hawaii's Lu'ukai was lost for good. The name means sea diver in Hawaiian and came with the price tag of $2.5 million. But it ended well, thanks to a privately funded research program funded by a very rich man with Microsoft ties. The late Paul Allen's ship, the Petrel, came to the rescue. When this drama unfolded in the summer of 2019, we reached out to the pilot of the little ROV. His name is Maximilian Kremer. We figured the ROV story, Lu'ukai Lost and Found, was his tale to tell.
We were operating with our 6,000 meter or 20,000 foot rated, remotely operated vehicle, which is essentially a deep sea drone. We were working about 100 kilometers or 60 miles north of Oahu at a place called Station Aloha. We had at first done a more industrial project with Professor Bruce Howe of UH Engineering. He is the principal investigator of the deepest internet-connected ocean bottom observatory in the world. It's called the Aloha Cabled Observatory. We were doing servicing on that. That went very well for about 8 days or so. And then we went into a follow-up study, a background study, for a project called Abyssal Food Webs. The PIs on those is Jeff Drazen and Craig Smith, both professors of oceanography at the University of Hawaii. They're heavily involved in the greater subject of deep sea mining. They're looking at the ecosystems that exist in those areas where the multinational mining companies would like to come in and harvest, as it's called, manganese nodules, also known as polymetallic nodules. They are highly enriched in very valuable elements such as cobalt, copper, nickel, manganese. anything you'd need to build batteries. Many, many billions of dollars worth down there, and everybody's licking their chops to get it. Of course, these are very fragile ecosystems. There's extremely low metabolism, extremely low sedimentation rates. We were all happy because we had done the hard work, we thought, with Bruce Howe at the Aloha Cabled Observatory. And with Jeff and Craig, it's very interesting. We do very calm transects across the deep ocean plains for an hour or two, say 1 kilometer or so, and then we'll stop and we'll collect interesting organisms that nobody's ever seen before, and we're enjoying ourselves. We had 3 days to go, and then we were going into a longer refit period where everybody could recharge. And on the third dive, we were minding our own business. Everything was working wonderfully. All the indications, electrical was great, power was great. The fiber optic telemetry was wonderful. Good images, nice samples. From 1 second to the next, all screens were black, blank, nothing coming up. And we said, that is not that unusual. You can lose telemetry just like you can lose a connection on your phone, say. I said, okay, well, let's restart the system and bring it back in. And so we restarted the system, and only one of the two components of the robot would come back, which is a heavy cage that hovers about 45 feet or so above the ocean floor and observes and provides power and telemetry to the actual robot that's working on the bottom. We got the cameras back for this cage that's called a TMS or tether management system. And into the camera comes a severed cable. And we were just slack-jawed because, oh my God, $2.5 million investment that SOAS made to break into, you know, modern cutting-edge technology on the ocean floor is stricken, is lost at 4,715 meters, that's 15,000 plus feet, on the abyssal plain in the middle of the northern Pacific. I mean, this is not the Gulf of Mexico where you have hundreds of operations where you can call a colleague and say, here, I lost my robot, can you come help me out, drag it back up? It was literally, holy cow, what are we going to do? It's interesting. That's why I love to have younger people that come into the organization. They have, you know, great enthusiasm. They think outside the box. And oftentimes they say things that the older guys tend to dismiss or something. But this one guy, Daniel Hinshaw, is a mechanical engineer, and he's also one of the manipulator operators. So I'm sure he's going to become a pilot soon. He mentioned, he said, you know, I think the research vessel Petrel, that's Paul Allen's vehicle. You know Paul Allen from Microsoft? I think they're somewhere in the Pacific. And we're like, well, what does that mean? Somewhere in the Pacific could be, you know, 4,000 miles away. He said, yeah, but they were looking at something maybe in the Philippines or something. And then older team members, Ian Griffith and Steve Price, recalled that the operations director on the research vessel Petrel was a former colleague of theirs, Rob Kraft. And they said, well, we should try and contact them and see if they can help us out because they have their own robot. They have their own deep sea drone that's rated to 6,500 meters, 23, almost 24,000 feet. And it is a marvelous tool, top of the line. I mean, you know, if you're somebody like Paul Allen, you can afford the best that money can buy. And sure enough, we contacted them, and maybe in this respect, the maritime industry still works a little bit like in the old days. If you know somebody and you've worked with somebody a long time ago and you had a good rapport, that's usually not forgotten because you trust each other, and especially when you work in the deep sea and the diving business. And so Rob Kraft responded very quickly and said, yes, in principle, that's possible because we are on our way from the Philippines to Honolulu.
Just by luck, sheer luck, right?
We're like, I think we just found a lottery ticket that may have a winning number. And so I was also involved with reporting the whole disaster to my superiors at UH, to management.
Yeah, break the bad news.
Yes, you got to do it. If something breaks, if something bad is going on, that's what you got to do. It's
Boy Scout honor.
You got to speak truth to power, and you got to come clean when something goes wrong. Anyway, they were also all over it. They said, give us the number, give us the contact of the petrol, and we will try and work it out with the federal agencies to see how that can be arranged. Petrol announced that they had some mechanical issues to take care of, and if it were possible, they would like to ask if we had some space at our pier, Pier 35, UH Marine Center, just right around from Costco there. And it happened so that at that time, there was mooring space available for them. I mean, now, the Petrel is a fairly large ship, over about 300 feet long, so it's pretty massive, a wonderful vessel. They came in late July, which was about 10 days after we lost her. And we immediately went to work with them and developed with the Petrel team of salvagers, although those guys are great pilots and manipulator operators, and most of them have salvage oil field backgrounds, and they're very good at what they do. I mean, if you check them out on the web, they have an unbelievable website, and you can get
so much
information of what they find, and the quality of their data is just wonderful. So they invited us on, and for us, it was just an eye-opener. I come from manned submersibles myself, so even after 5 years, I would still consider myself a fairly newcomer to the world of robotics and tethered vehicles. It was literally like Star Trek. I mean, you have an unbelievable control room with so many high-quality monitors, and, you know, the vehicle itself has two of the best manipulators that money can buy, the Schilling Titan IV, they're called. We have one that's our pride and joy on the Pisces 5 submersible. So we worked out a method to get it back with a so-called elevator that had about 290 pounds of lift. The elevator was deployed by us with our own research vessel, the Kilo Moana, during a Hawaii Ocean Time Series cruise that goes into that area. And so we deployed that elevator near the stricken ROV. The elevator, you just put a bunch of weights on that will drag it down to the ocean floor. And then 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, finally the Petrel was ready. They had taken care of all their needs, the mechanical repairs. It was time on August 28th to go up there and get it. We just got so lucky that on that day, August 29th, the ocean was flat calm. It was like a mirror up there. And we started the operation at 5 o'clock in the morning. Took about 2 hours for the Petrel ROV to reach the bottom. Took 20 minutes to find our ROV. Took another 20 minutes to find the elevator, transport the elevator over to the ROV, make a hookup with the lift cable, bring the Petrel ROV up on deck. And then once they were on deck and out of the way, we acoustically released the weights from that elevator. The elevator was now attached to ROV and had more buoyancy than the ROV had, negative buoyancy, and it dragged it all the way up. It took about 2.5 hours for it to come up. Then once it was on the surface, since conditions were so great, the main difficulty that we had anticipated, which was that it might be rough on the surface and we might have a very hard time to rig the ROV and the elevator back to the crane on the ship, was just child's play. It was really easy. So we got it back, and just before 2 o'clock, we had everything back on deck.
So did you celebrate?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. There was great, great relief and great hooting and hollering. And the Petrel is, of course, a private vessel. Unlike the federal vessels, they do not have a zero tolerance policy. And the crew of the Petrel, they knew how happy we were. And
broke out the beer?
Within 15 minutes, they had a big cooler of beers on the back deck and fired up the Barbie. And we had a really good time, yes.
And so how was the condition of the ROV?
We were just amazed. We took an image when we reached it on the ocean floor once we were close by, and she looked just pristine, except there was no tether, no cable on it. She had just been sitting on the ocean floor waiting for us to come back and get her. The only thing that looked out of place was the port side, so the left side manipulator that had slumped over a little bit. All the oil reservoirs were at the same filled state as we had left it 40 days earlier. There were several components, like thruster motors, one or two thruster motors that had suffered some pretty heavy corrosion during the time. But we brought her back up, and we rinsed her off, and we put her in the shop. And we got together, and it took us about 2 weeks to make sure, you know, you go through a very elaborate power-up process. Everything was working. It was just astounding. I think there was maybe one or two small power supplies for lights that had, you know, when the cable parted and there was a power surge that, you know, was broken and that could be replaced within a half a day.
So all the stars lined up for you?
All the stars lined up. I mean, in Germany, we call it Glück im Unglück. You're lucky within a disaster, you know, that it's just... It was terrible to lose it, and it was very stressful for all involved. But the day of the recovery, a rare confluence of luck and, of course, skill by the operators and also a good job by the planners.
So what does it say about the, I guess, the camaraderie with the mariners out there, the researchers?
Well, one thing that is age-old in the mariners' world is we all love to help each other out when it's serious. You may have just heard the Kilo Moana just returned from a cruise to Tahiti. And while they were doing research down there with a group out of Columbia University, there was a stricken sailing vessel, a stricken catamaran. It had sprung a leak, had a hole in one of the hulls. And the Kilo Moana was the closest vessel at 200 miles away. They received the SOS, and they were asked by, they were told by the equivalent of the Coast Guard in Tahiti that, well, you're the closest vessel. And they took them 2 days, and they steamed over there. And while they were steaming over there, they got together with the manufacturers of the catamaran, got the plans, and built essentially a fix that they could install as soon as they got there. So I think they lost about 48 hours, and the science group was also very gracious and professional, and they could work it into their schedule. So it was really a wonderful thing. It made the news in the maritime industry. And this was kind of similar with the Petrel and Rob craft.
Right, because I think there's probably the feeling that there's a, you know, it's man against nature out there, right? I mean, on the high seas. And when man can help man.
Yes, the ocean is boss. The ocean rules. And when the ocean wants to give something back, then it may be easier than you think. But if the ocean doesn't want to, you will never get it back. It will break you.
So, oh gosh, what did we learn from this? You folks just, you know, managed to reach out to the right people at the right time. Everything worked better than planned.
Well, what I learned from it was just because it went so flawlessly, this recovery from planning to recovery to organization with the agencies, it really, for me, became an example of how it can be done in a best-case scenario. So I put together a little talk, and I've given it so far once or twice, once to the Marine Technology Society, and it's almost like a best practices type of scenario, which everybody that works in the deep ocean is interested in. It's very difficult, this planetary exploration deep underneath what we call the big blue blanket. And when you're at 6,000 or 5,000 meters and you're at 9 or 10 or 11,000 pounds per square inch of pressure from all sides, the demands on the material and the technology are tremendous. And so every time people work through a technological hurdle, usually there's an interest to share that. I always like to think that luck favors the prepared. So if you do a good preparation and every once in a while conditions come together that your plan can work out perfectly. We just had a wonderful time that evening. We were all sitting around the back deck and we're just swapping sea stories. They were telling of adventures that they had, you know, finding the Indianapolis, or, you know, of their hopes and dreams when they were going out to Midway later, and of their future plans. What happened, you know, after the passing of Paul Allen, you know, how is that all working out? And so it was just a very collegial and positive gathering. We really enjoyed it.
Well, we thank the crew of the Petrel for getting our robotics unit back.
Yes, us too. Definitely a shout out to Rob Kraft and his guys.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That was University of Hawaii ROV operator Max Kremer telling us the high-stakes tale of the Lu'ukai's rescue. Kremer retired in December, and for decades he had operated submersibles with the University of Hawaii's Undersea Research Lab and researched underwater volcanoes.
And if you climb up in the tallest tree and get a quick glimpse of what the day might be, then you'll know deep inside it's still alive. So whenever you're lost at sea, remember getting lost and found, your whole world inside of one old town. Set your mind at ease with the tropical breeze and Uncle playing sake. We used to spend all day at the beach, shore brain fishing and sunburned cheeks. Take me back, take me back, take me back, take me back to you. Oh no, take me back, take me back, take me back, take me back to you.
How did a Honolulu resident end up in a shipwreck off the coast of Taiwan? Well, Jason Arnold joined the crew of the Princess Taiping, a replica of a 15th century Chinese warship known as a junk, in 2009. The 54-foot vessel was built using traditional techniques and was powered only by sail. It had no modern luxuries except for a radio. The Princess Taiping initially launched in June of 2008, and it reached California in November of that year. It was on the more treacherous journey back to China in early 2009 when it made a stop in Hawaii. HPR's Russell Subiono spoke with Arnold late last year about his remarkable story of survival.
At what point did you encounter the ship?
Sure. It was February 2009. They were moored here. There was a fuel dock at the Honolulu yacht area. And at the time, I was on the Huilana Kila paddling team. And so a few of us jumped in the canoes and we're like, oh, we're going to go, you know, practice. So we're paddling out of the Alawai. And we see the replica Chinese junk, the Princess Taiping, in the harbor there. And we're like, what is that? Right? It's just, you know, you don't see that type of ship every day. And so as we're paddling out, we're like, oh, you know, they're filming Pirates of the Caribbean. So it's probably one of the prop ships or something, you know. So we go out, we do our practice, and then come back in and just kind of pull up. We see a guy on deck and, hey, what is this ship for? You know, just asking general questions. And he starts explaining that the mission of this voyage is to double cross the Pacific Ocean. They've already made the Northern Crossing. They're on their way back to Taiwan. And then, you know, just a real quick, like, that's what we're doing. That's our voyage. And I'm like, wow, that's crazy. And this thing, you know, you guys are, you're like, yeah, you know, we're on our way back. And he said, hey, and since you guys, obviously, you're, you know, water people, if you know anyone that's interested in helping crew the boat back to Taiwan, we're looking for some people. Some of our crew are getting off here and they're going various places. So it just so happens that me and my good friend Lars, we played basketball together in college. He had just gotten back from Beijing where he was teaching English and basketball. And I was working, I was a senior analyst at First Hawaiian Bank, and I had just gone through a pretty terrible divorce and stuff. And so he actually convinced me to go back with him to Beijing to teach English and basketball. He's making great money and stuff like that. So we had already had teaching contracts and things like that. And that was to start in May of 2009. And so we go back to my apartment, have a few drinks. We're talking about it. He's like, hey, let's go check it out, right? So we go down, talk to the captain. And so my buddy Lars, he had sailed the English Channel. He was a world traveler. So while I was like married life, working at the bank, all that, he was traveling the world. So he had sailing background. I didn't. So the captain was impressed with Lars's, you know, background. And then he looks at me and he's like, you know, how are you with people? How are you on teams? And I said, I've been on teams my whole life and I'm good with people. So he's like, all right, come back down tomorrow. Let me think about it. So Lars and I go home. And then I was like, man, you know what? This is a great opportunity. If, you know, the captain doesn't want me, that's fine. But I think that you should do this. This is awesome. I'll meet up with you in Beijing. And so go back the next day. And the captain's name is Nielsen Liu. He's from Taiwan. He says, do you guys mind hoisting the mainsail? And so the mainsail, it's made out of cotton and bamboo battens. Mm. And it's on this kind of winch, very little mechanical advantage. So just to describe, Lars is 6'5", 6'6". He looks like a Viking, like, right? 'Cause he's a basketball player, right? And I'm pretty big myself. And so we hoist the mainsail and the captain's like, well, okay, can you let it down? We let it down. Can you do it again? We did it again. We did it three times. And the captain's like, you're on. He was like, it takes four guys to do what you two just did.
Oh, wow.
So he was like, you're on. So yeah, we had passports and then we left, I think it was February 16th, 2009.
And so after the ship departs, what were your duties? What was life like on the boat as you were sailing towards Taiwan?
We were split into two groups of six each, so there's 12 total crew. So 2 6-hour shifts a day. So for instance, it would be like midnight to 6 a.m. and then 12 noon to 6 p.m. for like my crew, let's say. And then the other crew would do fit in the other 12 hours. So everyone had their turn at steering the boat, at cooking. And this was all new to me. I did not take any courses. And on top of that, so Lars, being with his background, he spoke Mandarin. The captain's girlfriend, and the first mate, they were all from Taiwan. And the first mate didn't speak any English. The captain and his girlfriend spoke English, and I didn't speak any Mandarin at the time. So it was like a steep learning curve, right? Yeah. But I was completely immersed in the environment, and so I kind of picked it up pretty fast. So yeah, manning the sails, cooking, steering, and then just the basic maintenance, cleaning, things like that. But it was very, very, there was no luxuries on the ship at all. We had no refrigeration. We had water in water tanks. We had a gas stove for cooking, and we had a solar powered navigation system, but that was it. Everything else was like really bare bones, basic.
Do you catch a lot of the food that you ate?
Yeah, so it was almost like clockwork where we would just send out a hand lure around sunset and pull in a mahi-mahi. That mahi-mahi would feed a crew of 12 for like 3 days. So the first day was just, we would, you know, sashimi, and then we would make fillets and fish head soup. And I'm from Los Angeles originally, didn't grow up close to the ocean, very little camping. This was the first time I was like, wow, like I'm one with nature.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like you adapted pretty well? You adjusted pretty well?
You know, I tell people it was strange. And I don't know if people believe in past lives or anything, but there was a comfort that I had that was, I couldn't explain. I was like, I don't get seasick. I remember when we left, seeing the lights of Kauai and knowing that there was no turning back on this. So with the junk, it's a wind-powered boat, like you'd mentioned. Right. It's a flat-bottom boat, meaning that you can't sail against the wind. You have to go with the predominant wind and current. And so passing Kauai, I was like, there's no turning back.
Yeah, you were all in, yeah, at that point, right?
Right, right.
So the Princess Taiping set sail in February of 2009.
Correct.
The ship encounters a tragic ending in April of 2009, just 20 miles from reaching the end of the voyage near northeastern Taiwan. This Liberian-flagged Norwegian chemical tanker called the Champion Express rams the Princess Taiping.
Yes.
Sinking it.
Yes.
Can you talk about what you remember about that?
So we left Okinawa. Between Okinawa and Taiwan, we were expecting like a 3-4 day sail. We knew that there was a storm coming up from the south, but we had been through plenty of storms. And, you know, like you mentioned before, this was going to be a historical event. Chinese jumped across the Pacific Ocean. And by that time, we were all like, let's get this over with, right? And so set sail, 2 days of beautiful sailing. The morning of the third day, we start to get the effects of the storm that's coming up from the south. Winds are shifting. By the time that my crew, I think we're called starboard side crew, got off at midnight, we were in 40 knot winds and 20 foot seas. And as you're approaching a landmass in the ocean, the wave patterns change. So in the middle of the ocean, you have a predominant wave pattern. But as you're approaching the landmass, waves start to reflect. And so they can come at different directions. And so I was steering and a wave actually washed over the deck. So we were on all high alert after that. So I remember going to sleep that night. It's raining, 40 knot winds, 20 foot seas. And in those conditions, we can't sail. We have our sails in and we're just kind of trying to orient the boat to make sure that we don't get broadside.
Yeah.
So at midnight, my crew, we get off. And so I go down below deck. Once again, it was bare bones. During these conditions, I had to like sleep underneath a trash bag because it was water all in the sleeping area and stuff. But, you know, I'm closing my eyes and I'm like, you know, maybe hopefully by the morning, this storm will pass. And at night, we can see the loom of the island of Taiwan. And so maybe we'll be able to actually see the physical island, right? Because we're only about 20, 30 miles out. And so I was midnight. Around 2:30, my mate, John, in the bunk next to me, he wakes up and he's like, Jason, get up, get up. And so I love you, John, but John is a jumpy guy, you know. I see him go through the hatch on the main deck. And so I kind of get up and I'm looking and I can see the captain, and the captain is in his foul weather gear and he's waving the high powered beam at something. And once again, it's raining and it's stormy conditions and I'm just waking up. So I'm trying to put things together. And he's waving something and I can hear kind of like yelling from the back of the boat where the crew is. And I'm like, what's going on? And there was Mori-san, he was from Okinawa, and he was like pushing me. He didn't speak any English. So he's pushing me and I'm like, wait, I'm pushing him back. And the captain runs to the back of the boat and I'm still trying to get an angle to see what the captain was waving the high powered beam at. And then all of a sudden I see a row of lights. So it's new moon, it's stormy, the sky is pitch dark, and just a row of lights out in the distance. And I'm like, it looks like a skyscraper, like the top floor of a skyscraper. I was like, this is not making sense, right? And so I hear screaming, and then all of a sudden, our, I think, starboard side, the light illuminates the bow of the ship. And I'm like, I must be dreaming. This can't be real, right? And so once again, Morris just pushed me, and I'm like, wait a minute. I think I may have froze. I don't know. But the bow of the ship comes, and a wave washes over the deck and into the sleeping quarters, and then just, I'm underwater. If you can imagine, we're sitting, you and I are talking, and then a wave floods in here, and then the room starts to spin. So things would be hitting you, and you don't know, you can't orient yourself. You don't know which way is up, right, and all that kind of stuff. I can't tell you how long it was, but there was a point at which I was underwater, not being able to orient myself, and so that panic starts to set in, right? Yeah. And so now I'm starting to grab anything that is solid because things are hitting me, and I ball up and protecting my head and stuff. And the sensation that I got was like, it was almost like successive waves were coming in. So there was a point where it felt like the water level where I was at would fall a little bit, but then another wave would rush in and go back into the spinning. And I think that's because when the boat hit us, we went up on the marine bulb, the dolphin bulb that's in front, and actually broke into two halves. Wow. And bounced along the side of the tanker. And so when we finally got free of the tanker and the wake of the tanker, I pop up to the surface and Mori-san and I were bear hugging each other. Pop up to the surface, right? Because we both like. And so what was the deck that was covering us was gone. I looked to the back and the crew that was on deck, they're at the back of the boat, like holding on. And once again, it's new moon. Mm-hmm. They have their life jackets on. Me and Mori-san don't. And there's that flasher that flashes, and so that's like temporarily blinding. And then look up and see a tanker, like the back of the tanker right there, and actually see people running back and forth on the deck of the tanker looking over at us. But once again, we're in 20-foot seas, 40-knot winds, and it's just complete chaos.
Well, the good news is that nobody died.
Nobody died.
Yep. Nobody died. Mm-hmm. Although the tanker didn't stop to give assistance, they did send a distress signal. And the Princess Taiping's captain and all crew members, including yourself, mm-hmm. were rescued by helicopter and ship after several hours in the water. What was going through your mind as you were in the water, hoping that rescue would come?
It's interesting. I think your crew makes a big difference on how you respond. And thank God I had my best friend Lars there, right? And we were cracking jokes, right? We were like, this is crazy. You know, when we get back, we're going to tell this story and all that kind of stuff. But we were in the water for a good 6-7 hours. So let me back up a little bit. I don't know if that's accurate, but we actually had to find our own EPIRB. I don't think that the Champion Express sent out a beacon for us to get rescued.
Okay.
Kind of denied they actually hit us. So after they hit us, we were actually missing two people. We were missing Kenjo-san, another sailor from Okinawa, and Thomas Cook. Myself, Lars, and John, and Liz, we're like the three youngest crew members and probably strongest swimmers. So we have to find these two of our members of our crew, two guys, and the EPIRB. And the EPIRB that we had was a manual EPIRB. So there are EPIRBs that are water activated. I don't know if you know what an EPIRB is, but it's basically an emergency beacon that is sent out to let you know that there are sailors in distress. Ours, you actually have to physically find it, push it to activate it. Without this EPIRB, no one would have known that we were in trouble. And so Lars, myself, John, Liz, we're trying to swim around the wreckage. And once again, 20-foot seas, new moon, and your brain wants to make things floating in the water. It wants to make it look like what you're looking for because you're kind of in a panicked mental state. So, you know, a bucket may look like somebody's shoulder. So you go over there and you grab it. Oh, it's not, because you want to find your crew members and stuff. So anyways, as time is going, my thought was, okay, the boat that hit us, they're going to send down somebody, but we still got to find our crew. So I'm looking up at the boat, you know, waiting for them to send down a boat to come and get us. And then, like, I don't know how long it was. It felt like 30 minutes. I see a wake come out of the back of their boat and they just start taking off.
Wow.
And it was like, in the middle of all this, it was like that pin drop moment where nobody said anything. And we were all just like, wait a minute, this is not the script. This is not how this is supposed to go. So then we were like, we really got to find this EPIRB, Lars and John and Liz and I. And so we're looking through all the debris. And as time is going on, the conditions, the debris, the field is getting larger and larger. Right. And I remember Lars and I, we looked at each other. We're in the water, swimming around, life jackets and stuff. And so we looked at each other and like, it's been too long. Because where we were looking was where the captain's quarters used to be, but now everything on the deck of the boat is now gone. We're looking at each other and just kind of like, it's gone. And I kid you not, Russell, I don't know if you believe in God, but this was a godly moment. The EPIRB bubbled up between us.
Oh my gosh.
True story. Like, I got goosebumps as I'm telling it. Lars grabs it, presses it. Okay, so now we know that somebody at least knows that we're here and we need help. We still got to find Kenjo-san and Thomas Cook. By this time, the ship is gone and we're still doing our search for Thomas Cook. And so we were going out just as far as like maybe 20 yards or so. And then coming back and just kind of doing this search pattern. And John had swam out and then he just like, he took off. I think Lars went out and helped him. And we found Thomas Cook. When we pulled him back in, he had a fractured skull. He was like, my neck is broken. He had a fracture in the second vertebrae of his spine and a compound fractured arm. And this was like 3 hours after we had gotten hit. And he was not in good shape. So it was pretty bad, but everyone made it. We got rescued. My thoughts were, at that point, especially around that 6 hour mark, I didn't know if I was going to make it or not. At that point, we're all going hypothermic. And so I really started to think about my life up until that point. And like I'd mentioned earlier, I'd gone through just a terrible divorce. And I felt that I had done things that I was supposed to do, right? So I went to college, you know, I'm a good Christian boy. A father, two sons, go to work every day, all that kind of stuff. And a part of me was happy with all of that, but a part of me was like, I never really lived my life. And so I kind of said a little prayer that, you know, if I survive this, the one thing that I'm going to make sure is that the people that are around me, I'm going to make sure that they know that I love them. Because that's all I could think about. It's like, I'm going to miss my family, my friends, and maybe I didn't let them know that I love them, I appreciate them, I value their friendship, their relationship. And then, too, live my life. I still love the ocean. I take my boys out. I encourage people, if they can, to go out. The ocean is beautiful. You've never seen stars so bright or brilliant sunsets and sunrises, and just, it's beautiful.
That was Honolulu firefighter Jason Arnold talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about his story of survival at sea aboard the shipwrecked Princess Taiping 15 years ago. The captain and the entire crew survived. Arnold said that he had lost everything he brought with him, including his passport and the journal that he had kept for 10 years.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
In public radio, there's a phenomenon called the driveway moment. It's when you're driving somewhere and you reach your destination, but you linger in the car just so you can catch the end of a great story. Well, with the HPR mobile app, you can pick up that story anytime you want. Replay national shows as well as local news stories and make driveway moments a thing of the past. Get the HPR app in the App Store or on Google Play.
You're tuned to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. KHPR Honolulu, KKUA Wailuku, KANO Hilo, KHPH Kailua Kona, KIPL Lihue, and KJHF Kualapu'u.
Civil War steamships, whaling ships, and World War II aircraft, those are remnants of maritime history, all sitting on the ocean floor. For our final segment, we hunt a 2018 interview with marine archaeologist Hans von Tilburg, who sat down with us to share stories of the sea.
Unlike historic properties or archaeological sites on land, which everyone can see and are often kind of, you know, assessed and then become something else, get built on. Things that are lost in the ocean oftentimes go right to the bottom and they're just sitting there. So when we find them and understand what we're looking at, they can open these windows onto stories that most folks have forgotten for a long time.
And there is a lot of activity that is underway. They're talking about some offshore wind farms, undersea cables, and a lot of that is going to disturb what's on the ocean floor.
It has the potential to. That's exactly right. So that's why, in fact, my agency got involved in assisting, you know, another agency in putting together the background snapshot, the understanding of what's out there now in terms of historic shipwrecks, aircraft that have been lost for years and years in Hawaii, just to understand from the cultural resource perspective, if there was, you know, a project in those areas, what types of things could be in that area exactly?
And so the idea is then we need to protect what's there, but we need to identify what's there.
Sure. You're, you know, not everything's going to be historic properties per se or, you know, rate the level of protection that other things might, but some things are old and significant. And so it would be worthy in those cases to discuss, you know, what could be done if a project could have potential impacts. Absolutely.
And you've done a lot of research in this area. You also wrote a book about Civil War ship that's out there.
Yeah. In fact, that's one of the stories, the USS Saginaw. just the fact that there was a civil warship out in the middle of the Pacific here, trying to open up the channel at Midway Atoll before there was anything else there, really, just kind of a deserted atoll island back in 1870. It's a great story of shipwreck and survival and rescue voyage. It's one of the epics of the Pacific, I think.
What was the maybe one thing that struck you as you were doing your research about that ship?
Well, that particular case, you know, that was a small vessel, a sidewheel vessel, in a Civil War era vessel, so not really built for long duty at sea, but there were 93 sailors on board. And this was from a day when the U.S. Navy was very multinational, actually. Not everyone wanted to go into the Navy, so there were 17 different languages being spoken on that small sidewheel vessel. And those guys were stranded at Kure Atoll near Midway for months. But the funny thing about that now, they probably didn't mention it back then, is they were all immediately on the enforced Atkins diet. They missed the bread. They missed the sugar terribly because there was nothing but, unfortunately, the monk seals and the albatross for them to survive. It was a difficult many months before they got off that island.
And is that in any particular area that may, you know, it's in the path of undersea cable or any of these other offshore developments that's being proposed at all?
Well, that's in an area in the Papahānaumokuakea Marine National Monument. So that's, you know, fairly well protected. But the inventory that we worked on for Bureau of Ocean Energy Management addresses all of the wrecks around the main Hawaiian Islands down here. And many of those are close to areas that could be proposed as offshore wind development, which is exactly why BOEM, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, was looking for this type of inventory information.
So how do you actually conduct the surveys and do these studies when you go out and document what's there?
Well, it kind of depends on how deep the site is and the nature of the environment. You know, if it's diveable and we have the capacity, we'll want people with eyes on, you know, looking closely at artifacts and features. But a lot of ocean is pretty deep. And so then we're talking about, you know, a remote operated vehicle, an ROV dropped from a ship to do video survey, or even the three-man research submersibles, the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. And those folks have found a lot of wrecks in the deep ocean in the past. So those are a little more involved platforms for doing this type of research.
And are we still going to have Hurl to tap in the future? Because I know their funding was in question.
Funding is difficult, and I certainly hope they're able to stay and remain active in the islands because despite the advances in, you know, ROV, robot technology, which is remarkable, there are some things that manned submersibles can do, untethered submersibles can do, that tethered vehicles cannot. You know, we're part of a larger historic preservation field. And so that's always been just one component of marine resource conservation and preservation. And so hopefully what we've been able to achieve, and Office of National Marine Sanctuaries is one example where we have multiple archaeologists and preservationists across our system. Hopefully we can maintain our level of capacity and continue to do the kind of historical and archaeological work in lakes and under the oceans.
Right. I mean, because we hear about the accounts of the explorers, and a lot of these vessels, you know, perished on the open sea. And then it's like, okay, when we do find them, what's still intact? What is there on board these ships that could tell us more about the story?
Mm-hmm. That's very environmentally related, too. I mean, lots of warm marine tropical waters, you know, the wood will be decimated by the shipworm, Tritonavalis, but the diagnostic artifacts, the tools, the engines, the tripods, the anchors, cannons, you know, other stuff does fairly well while the wood might have vanished. But then later vessels, turn of the century, iron hulls, steel hulls, you have a different signature, a different footprint under the ocean. So it really changes from site to site and from era to era on what you can find underwater. But it does take some careful assessment then to take that into consideration.
What about the technology that's available? Because, you know, we hear a lot about, oh, gosh, you know, we've got virtual reality when you get cameras down, you know, under the ocean that you can really document a lot and then bring some of those visuals back up for everybody to see and learn from.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question because that is changing very quickly. remote sensing technology to discover these types of properties underwater, recording technology to assess the sites, diving technology for people to go deeper and deeper with closed circuit rebreathers, mixed gas closed circuit. So there is more access and more discovery going on, but which also means that, you know, we don't have to look at these deep water sites and bring everything up. That costs a lot to stabilize and conserve, and then where's the museum that's going to take it? We can do our work by just recording the site as it is in situ and share that with the public and learn a lot and not have to engage a whole nother level of effort and funding.
I know in recent years when we've done stories about these research vessels that are out there, you know, they can actually in real time show us the images. Whereas, you know, in the old days with Hurl, we used to wait until the scientists came back from their trip and then downloaded the video and then, you know, to see what they saw. But now it's just instant. You can see it as they're doing it.
That's been really fun. That's been a change in the past few years. And, you know, it's changing the way that we do what we do and how we share it with the public. It's actually been fantastic. If we can do a live dive survey from discovery of something that goes from, you know, maybe it's a shipwreck, maybe it's just a big rock, and the ROV goes in and broadcasts that signal to the internet and folks are watching, they share in the discussion that we historians and archaeologists are conducting and share in the actual moments of discovery and analysis of that shipwreck site. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I just love seeing these fantastic creatures, you know, undersea creatures, and they just look like from another world. And to be able to kind of share that moment with the scientists, we're like, whoa, what was that?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, when we do the live mission, certainly we'll have archaeologists, historians, and biologists along because there will be those same creatures, especially if we're looking at a section of seafloor that's, you know, relatively flat and uneventful and all of a sudden there's a shipwreck. That's habitat often. So there are pluses and minuses to these types of sites environmentally, and there will be some amazing creatures living in those wrecks.
That was underwater archaeologist Hans von Tilburg. He's with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries Maritime Heritage Program in the Pacific Islands. Well, that is it for our Aloha Friday show. Coming up next week, we check in on cell phone policies in schools, why some are saying enough is enough. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori DeJournay. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.